It cost us 2,000 credits.
Then defensively,
well, what of it? Tomorrow, 2,000 credits will be 2,000 pieces of paper and nothing else.
Sure, Faro said. So we bought the place and rigged it up with black velvet from top to bottom so as to get as perfect a darkness as possible. Then we punched tiny holes in the ceiling and through the roof and covered them with little metal caps, all of which could be shoved aside simultaneously at the close of a switch. At least we didn't do that part ourselves. We got a carpenter and an electrician and some others. Money didn't count. The point was that we could get the light to shine through those holes in the roof so that we could get a star-like effect.
What we imagined a star-like effect would be,
Imad amended. Not a breath was drawn during the pause that followed. Athor said stiffly,
You had no right to make a private...
Faro seemed abashed. I know, sir, but frankly, Imad and I thought the experiment was a little dangerous. If the effect really worked, we half expected to go mad. From what Dr. Sheeran says about all this, we thought that would be rather likely. We felt that we alone should take the risk. Of course, if we found that we could retain our sanity, it occurred to us that we might be able to develop immunity to the real thing and then expose the rest of you to what we had experienced. But things didn't work out at all.
Why? What happened?
It was Imad who answered.
We shut ourselves in and allowed our eyes to get accustomed to the dark. It's an extremely creepy feeling because the total darkness makes you feel as if the walls and ceiling are crashing in on you.
But we got over that and pulled the switch.
The caps fell away, and the roof glittered all over with little dots of light.
And?
And nothing. That was the wacky part of it, so... As far as we understood the Book of Revelations, we were experiencing the effect of seeing stars against a background of darkness, but nothing happened. It was just a roof with holes in it and bright points of light coming through, and that's just what it looked like. We tried it over and over again. That's what kept us so late, but there just wasn't any effect at all.
There was a shocked silence. All eyes turned to Sheeran, who stood motionless, mouth open. Theramon was the first to speak. You know what this does to the whole theory you've built up, Sheeran, don't you? He was grinning with relief. But Sheeran raised his hand.
Not so fast, Theramon. Just let me think this through. These so-called stars that the boys constructed, the total time of their exposure to darkness...
He fell silent. Everyone watched him, and then he snapped his fingers, and when he lifted his head, there was neither surprise nor uncertainty in his eyes.
Of course!
He never finished. Thalanda, who had been up in the observatory dome exposing photographic plates of the sky at 10-second intervals as the time of eclipse drew near, came rushing in, waving her arms in wild circles that would have been worthy of Imad at his most excited.
Dr. Athor! Dr. Athor!
Athor turned.
What is it?
We just found... We came walking right into the dome. You won't believe this, Dr. Athor.
Slow down, child. What happened? Who came walking in?
There were sounds of a scuffle in the hall and a sharp clang. Binet, starting to his feet, rushed out the door and came to a sudden halt, crying,
What the deuce?
Davnit and Hikkinen, who should have been up in the dome with Thalanda, were out there. The two astronomers were struggling with the third figure, a lithe, athletic-looking man in his late 30s with strange, curling red hair, a thin, sharp-featured face, icy blue eyes. They dragged him into the room and stood holding him with his arms gripped tightly behind his back. The stranger wore the dark robe of the Apostles of Flame.
Philemon 66,
Athor cried, and in the same breath from Theramon.
Philemon, what in the name of darkness are you doing here?
Quietly, in a cold, commanding tone, the apostle said,
It's not in the name of darkness that I have come to you this evening, but in the name of light.
Athor stared at Thalanda.
Where did you find this man?
I told you, Dr. Athor, we were busy with the plates, and then we heard him. He had come right in and was standing behind us. Where is Athor? He said. I must see Athor.
Call the security guards,
Athor said, his face darkening with rage.
The observatory is supposed to be sealed this evening. I want to know how this man succeeded in getting past the guards.
Obviously, you've got an apostle or two on the payroll, Theramon said pleasantly. Naturally, they'd have been only too obliging when the apostle Philemon showed up and asked them to unlock the gate.
Athor shot him a blistering glance. But the look on his face indicated that the old astronomer realized the probable accuracy of Theramon's guess. Everyone in the room had formed a ring around Philemon now. They were all staring at him in astonishment. Sephira, Theramon, Binet, Athor, and the rest. Calmly, Philemon said,
I am Philemon 66. Special Adjutant to His Serenity, Mandior 71. I have come this evening not as a criminal, as you seem to think, but as an envoy from His Serenity. Do you think you could persuade these two zealots of yours to release me, Athor?
Athor gestured irritatedly.
Let him go.
Thank you,
Polyman said. He rubbed his arms and adjusted the set of his robe. Then he bowed in gratitude. Or was it only mock gratitude to Athor? The air around the apostles seemed to tingle with some special electricity.
Now then,
Athor said,
what are you doing here? What do you want?
Nothing, I suspect, that you would give me of your own free will.
You're probably right about that.
Polyman said, when you and I met some months ago, Athor, it was, I would say, a very tense meeting, a meeting of two men who might well have looked upon themselves as princes of hostile realms. To you, I was a dangerous fanatic. To me, you were the leader of a band of godless sinners, and yet we were able to come to a certain area of agreement, which was, you recall, that on the evening of Thaptah 19th, darkness would fall upon Kalgash and would remain for many hours.
Athor scowled.
Come to the point, if there is one, Folliman. Darkness is about to fall, and we don't have a lot of time.
Folliman replied, to me, the coming of darkness was being sent upon us by the will of the gods. To you, it represented nothing more than the soulless movement of astronomical bodies. Very well, we agreed to disagree. I provided you with certain data that had been in the possession of the apostles since the previous year of godliness. Certain tables of movements of the suns in the sky, and other even more abstruse data. In return, you promised to prove the essential truth of the creed of our faith, and to make that proof known to the people of Kalgash.
Looking at his watch, Athor said,
and I did exactly that. What does your master want of me now? I've fulfilled my end of the bargain.
Polyman smiled faintly, but said nothing. There was an uneasy stir in the room.
I asked him for astronomical data, yes,
Athor said, looking around.
Data that only the apostles had, and it was given to me. For that, thank you. In return, I did agree, in a manner of speaking, to make public my mathematical confirmation of the apostles' basic tenet that darkness would descend on Thaptah 19th.
There was no real need for us to give you anything,
was the proud retort.
Our basic tenet, as you call it, was not in need of proof. It stands proven by the Book of Revelations.
For the handful that constitute your cult, yes,
Athor snapped.
Don't pretend to mistake my meaning. I offered to present scientific background for your beliefs, and I did.
The cultist's eyes narrowed bitterly.
Yes, you did. With a fox's subtlety for your pretended explanation, backed our beliefs, and at the same time, removed all necessity for them. You made of the darkness and of the stars a natural phenomenon, and removed all their real significance. That was blasphemy.
If so, the fault isn't mine. The facts exist. What can I do but state them?
Your facts are a fraud and a delusion.
Athor's face grew mottled with rage.
How do you know?
And the answer came with the certainty of absolute faith.
I know.
The director purpled even more. Bine started to go to his side, but Athor waved him away.
And what does Mandior 71 want us to do? He still thinks, I suppose, that in trying to warn the world to take measures against the menace of madness, we are somehow interfering with his attempt to seize power after the eclipse. Well, we aren't succeeding. I hope that makes him happy.
The attempt itself has done harm enough, and what you are trying to achieve here this evening will make things worse.
What do you know of what we're trying to achieve here this evening?
Athor demanded.
Smoothly, Folliman said, we know that you've never abandoned your hope of influencing the populace. Having failed to do it before the darkness had the flames, you intend to come forth afterward, equipped with photographs of the transition from daylight to darkness. You mean to offer a rational explanation to the survivors of what happened, and to put aside in a safe place your supposed evidence of your beliefs, so that at the end of the next year of godliness, your successors in the realm of science will be able to step forward and guide humanity in such a way that the darkness can be resisted.
Someone's been saying things, Bine whispered. Solomon went on.
All this works against the interests of Mondeor 71, obviously. And it is Mondeor 71 who is the appointed prophet of the gods, the one who is intended to lead mankind through the period ahead.
It's high time you came to the point,
Athor said in a frigid tone.
Polyman nodded.
The point is simply this. Your ill-advised and blasphemous attempt to gain information by means of your devilish instruments must be stopped. I only regret that I could not have destroyed your infernal devices with my own hands.
Is that what you had in mind?
It wouldn't have done you much good. All our data, except for the direct evidence we intend collecting right now, is already safely cached and well beyond the possibility of harm. Bring it forth! Destroy it!
What?
Destroy all your work. Destroy your instruments. In return for which, I will see to it that you and all your people are protected against the chaos that is certain to break loose when nightfall comes.
Now there was laughter in the room. Crazy, someone said. Absolutely nuts.
Not at all, Philemon said. Devout, yes. Dedicated to a cause beyond your comprehension, yes. But I'm not crazy. I'm quite sane, I assure you. I think this man here,
he indicated Theramon, would testify to that. And he's not known for his gullibility.
But I place my cause above all other things. This night is crucial in the history of the world. And when tomorrow dawns, godliness must triumph. I offer you an ultimatum. You people are to end your blasphemous attempt to provide rational explanations for the coming of darkness this evening and accept his serenity, Mondeor 71, as the true voice of the god's will. When morning comes, you will go forth to do Mondeor's work among mankind, and no more will be heard of eclipses or orbits or the law of universal gravitation or the rest of your foolishness.
And if we refuse,
said Athor, looking almost amused by Philemon's presumptuousness.
Then,
said Philemon coolly,
a band of angry people led by the Apostles of Flame will ascend this hill and destroy your observatory and everything within it.
Enough, Athor said. Call security. Have this man thrown out of here.
You have exactly 1 hour,
Philemon said, unperturbed.
And then the army of holiness will attack.
He's bluffing, Sheeran said suddenly. Athor, as though he hadn't heard, said again,
Call security! I want him out of here!
Damn it, Athor, what's wrong with you?
Sheeran cried.
If you turn him loose, he'll get out there to fan the flames. Don't you see? Chaos is what all these apostles have been living for, and this man's a master at creating it.
What are you suggesting?
Lock him up, Sheeran said. Stash him away in a closet and slap a padlock on him and keep him there for the duration of the time of darkness. It's the worst possible thing we could do to him. If he's locked away like that, he won't see the darkness, and he won't see the stars. It doesn't take much of a knowledge of the fundamental creed of the apostles to realize that for him to be hidden from the stars when they appear will mean the loss of his immortal soul. Lock him up, Athor. It's not only what's safest for us, it's what he deserves.
And afterward,
breathed Philemon fiercely,
when you have all lost your minds, there'll be no one to let me out. This is a sentence of death. I know as well as you do what the coming of the stars will mean. I know it far better than you. With your minds gone, you won't give any thought to freeing me. Suffocation or slow starvation, is it? About what I might have expected from a group of scientists.
He made the word sound obscene.
But it won't work. I've taken the precaution of letting my followers know that they are to attack the observatory precisely an hour from now, unless I appear and order them not to. Locking me away, then, will achieve nothing useful to you. Within an hour, it'll bring your own destruction upon you, that's all. And then my people will free me, and together, joyously, ecstatically, we will watch the coming of the stars.
A vein throbbed in Philemon's temple.
Then tomorrow, when you are all babbling madmen, damned forever by your deeds, we will set about the creation of a wondrous new world.
Sheeran glanced doubtfully at Athor, but Athor looked hesitant too. Bine, standing next to Theramon, murmured,
What do you think? Is he bluffing?
But the newspaper man didn't reply. He had gone pale to the lips.
Look at that.
The finger he pointed toward the window was shaking, and his voice was dry and cracked. There was a simultaneous gasp as every eye followed the pointing finger,
and for one moment stared frozenly. Dovim was chipped on one side. 25. The tiny bit of encroaching blackness was perhaps the width of a fingernail, but to the staring watchers it magnified itself into the crack of doom. For Theremin, the sight of that small arc of darkness struck with terrible force. He winced and put his hand to his forehead and turned away from the window. He was shaken to the roots of his soul by that little chip in Dovim's side. Theremin, the skeptic. Theremin, the mocker. Theremin, the tough-minded analyst of other people's folly.
Gods, how wrong I was.
As he turned, his eyes met Sephira's. She was at the other side of the room looking at him. There was contempt in her eyes. Or was it pity? He forced himself to meet her gaze and shook his head sadly, as though to tell her with all the humility there was in him,
I fouled things up and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It seemed to him that she smiled. Maybe she had understood what he was trying to say. Then the room dissolved in shrieking confusion for a moment, as everyone began to rush frenziedly around. And a moment after that, the confusion gave way to an orderly scurry of activity, as the astronomers leaped to their assigned tasks, some running upstairs to the observatory dome to watch the eclipse through the telescopes, some going to the computers, some using handheld instruments to record the changes in Dovim's disk. At this crucial moment, there was no time for emotion. They were merely scientists with work to do. Theremin alone, in the midst of it all, looked about for Bine and found him finally sitting at a keyboard madly working out some sort of problem. Of Aethor, there was no sign at all. Shirin appeared at Theremin's side and said prosaically,
First contact must have been made 5 or 10 minutes ago. A little early, but I suppose there were plenty of uncertainties involved in the calculations despite all the efforts that went into them.
He smiled.
You ought to get away from that window, man.
Why is that? Said Theremin, who had swung around again to stare at Dovim.
Aethor is furious, the psychologist whispered. He missed first contact on account of this fuss with Folliman. You're in a vulnerable position standing where you are. If Aethor comes by this way, he's likely to try to throw you out the window.
Theremin nodded shortly and sat down. Shirin looked at him, eyes wide with surprise.
The devil, man, you're shaking.
Eh? Theremin licked dry lips and then tried to smile. I don't feel very well, and that's a fact. The psychologist's eyes hardened.
You're not losing your nerve, are you?
No, cried Theremin in a flash of indignation. Give me a chance, will you? You know, Shirin, I wanted to believe all this eclipse rigmarole, but I couldn't. I honestly couldn't. It all seemed like the sheerest woolly fantasy to me. I wanted to believe it for Bine's sake, for Sephira's sake, even for Aethor's sake in a strange way. But I couldn't. Not until just this minute. Give me a chance to get used to the idea, all right? You've had months. It's hitting me all at once.
I see what you mean, Shirin said thoughtfully. Listen, have you got a family, parents, wife, children?
Theremin shook his head. No, nobody I need to worry about. Well, I have a sister, but she's 2,000 miles away. I haven't even spoken with her in a couple of years.
Well then, what about yourself?
What do you mean?
You could try to get to our sanctuary. They'd have room for you there. There's probably still time. I could call them and say that you're on the way, and they'd unlock the gate for you.
So you think I'm scared stiff, do you?
You said yourself you didn't feel so good.
Well, maybe I don't. But I'm here to cover the story. That's what I intend to do. There was a faint smile on the psychologist's face.
I see. Professional honor, is that it?
You might call it that. Wearily, Theremin said, Besides, I helped in a big way to undermine Aethor's preparedness program. Or have you forgotten? Do you really think I'd have the gall now to go running for shelter into the very sanctuary I was poking fun at, Shirin?
I hadn't seen it that way.
I wonder if there's any more of that miserable wine hidden around here somewhere. If ever there was a time when a fellow needed a drink...
Shh, Shirin said. He nudged Theremin violently. Do you hear that? Listen!
Theremin glanced in the direction Shirin was indicating. Folliman 66 stood by the window, a look of wild elation on his face. The apostle was droning something to himself in a low sing-song tone. It made the newspaper man's skin crawl.
What's he saying?
He whispered. Can you make it out?
He's quoting the book of Revelations, 5th chapter,
replied Sharon. Then urgently,
"Keep quiet and listen, will you?"
The apostle's voice rose suddenly in an increase of fervor.
"And it came to pass in those days that the sun, Dovim, held lone vigil in the sky for ever longer periods as the revolutions passed, until such time as for full half a revolution it alone, shrunken and cold, shone down upon Calgash. And men did assemble in the public squares and in the highways there to debate and to marvel at the sight, for a strange fear and misery had seized their spirits. Their minds were troubled and their speech confused, for the souls of men awaited the coming of the stars. And in the city of Trigon, at high noon, Vendret too came forth and said unto the men of Trigon, 'Lo, ye sinners, though ye scorn the ways of righteousness, yet will the time of reckoning come. Even now the cave approaches to swallow Calgash, yea, and all it contains.' And in that moment as he spoke, the lip of that cave of darkness passed the edge of Dovim, so that to all Calgash it was hidden from sight. Loud were the cries and lamentations of men as it vanished, and great the fear of the soul with which they were afflicted. And then it came to pass that the darkness of the cave fell full upon Calgash in all its terrible weight, so that there was no light to be seen anywhere on all the surface of the world. Men were even as blinded, nor could one see his neighbor, though he felt his breath upon his face. And in this blackness there appeared the stars in countless number, and their brightness was as the brightness of all the gods in concourse assembled. And with the coming of the stars there came also a music, which had a beauty so wondrous that the very leaves of the trees turned to tongues that cried out in wonder. And in that moment the souls of men departed from them and fled upward to the stars, and their abandoned bodies became even as beasts, yea, even as dull brutes of the wild, so that through the darkened streets of the cities of Calgash they prowled with wild cries like the cries of beasts. From the stars then there reached down the heavenly flames that was the bearer of the will of the gods, and where the flames touched, the cities of Calgash were consumed, even to utter destruction, so that of man and of the works of man nothing whatever remained. Even then..."
There was a subtle change in Fahleman's tone. His eyes had not shifted, but somehow it seemed that he had become aware of the absorbed attention of the other two. Easily, without pausing for breath, he altered the timbre of his voice so that it rose in pitch and the syllables became more liquid. Theremin, caught by surprise, frowned. The words seemed to be on the border of familiarity. There had been nothing more than an elusive shift in the accent, a tiny change in the vowel stress. Yet Theremin no longer had the slightest idea of what Fahleman was saying. "Maybe Sephira would be able to understand him now," Sheeran said. "He's probably speaking the liturgical tongue now, the old language of the previous year of godliness that the Book of Revelations was supposedly translated from." Theremin gave the psychologist a peculiar look. "You know a lot about this, don't you? What's he saying, then?" "You think I can tell you? Oh, I've done a little studying lately, yes, but not that much. I'm just guessing at what he's talking about. Weren't we going to lock him in a closet?"
Let him be," Theremin said. "What difference does it make now? It's his big moment. Well, let him enjoy it."
He shoved his chair back and ran his fingers through his hair. His hands weren't shaking any longer.
"Funny thing," he said. "Now that it's all actually begun, I don't feel jittery anymore."
"No?"
"Why should I?" Theremin said. A note of hectic gaiety had crept into his voice. "There's nothing I can do to stop what's going to happen, is there? So I'll just try to ride it out. Do you think the stars are really going to appear?"
"Not a clue," Sheeran said. "Maybe Bine would know."
"Or Aethor."
Leave Aethor alone," said the psychologist, laughing. "He just passed through the room and gave you a look that should have killed you."
Theremin made a wry face. "I'll have plenty of crow to eat when all this is over, I know. What do you think, Sheeran? Is it safe to watch the show outside?"
"When the darkness is total..."
"I don't mean the darkness. I can handle darkness, I think. I mean the stars."
"The stars?" Sheeran repeated impatiently. "I told you, I don't know anything about them."
"Well, they're probably not as terrifying as the Book of Revelations would want us to think. If that pinpoint in the ceiling experiment of those two students means anything..." He turned his hands palms upward as though they might hold the answer. Tell me, Sharon, what do you think? Won't some people be immune to the effects of the darkness and the SARS? Sharon shrugged. He pointed to the floor in front of them. Novim was past its zenith now, and the square of bloody sunlight that outlined the window upon the floor had moved a few feet toward the center of the room, where it lay like the terrible stain of some ghastly crime. Theremin stared at its dusky color thoughtfully. Then he swung around and squinted once more into the sun itself. The chip in its side had grown to a black encroachment that covered a third of its visible disk. Theremin shuddered. Once, jokingly, he had talked with Bine of dragons in the sky. Now it seemed to him that the dragon had come, that it had swallowed five of the suns already, that it was nibbling enthusiastically at the only one that remained. Sheeran said, "There are probably 2 million people in Sorrow City who are all trying to join the apostles at once. They'll be holding one giant revival meeting down at Mondior's headquarters, I'll bet. Do I think there's immunity to the darkness effects? Well, we're about to discover if there is, aren't we?" "There must be. How else would the apostles keep the Book of Revelations going from cycle to cycle, and how on Kalgash did it get written in the first place? There must have been some sort of immunity. If everyone had gone mad, who would have been left to write the book?" "Very likely the members of the secret cult hid themselves away in sanctuaries until it was all over, just as some of us are doing tonight," Sheeran said. "Not good enough. The Book of Revelations is set up as an eyewitness account. That seems to indicate they had first-hand experience of the madness and survived it." "Well," said the psychologist, "there are three kinds of people who might remain relatively unaffected. First, the very few who don't get to see the stars at all. The blind, let's say, or those who drink themselves into a stupor at the beginning of the eclipse and stay that way until the end."
They don't count. They're not really witnesses."
"I suppose not. The second group, though, young children, to whom the world as a whole is too new and strange for anything to seem more unusual than anything else. They wouldn't be frightened by the darkness or even the stars, I suspect. Those would just be two more curious events in an endlessly surprising world. You see that, don't you?"
Theremin nodded doubtfully.
"I suppose so."
"Lastly, there are those whose minds are too coarse-grained to be entirely toppled. The very insensitive might scarcely be affected. The real clods. They just shrug and wait for Onos to rise, I suppose."
"So the Book of Revelation was written by insensitive clods?" Theremin asked, grinning.
"Oh, hardly. It would have been written by some of the keenest minds of the new cycle. And it would have been based on the fugitive memories of the children, combined with the confused, incoherent babblings of the half-mad morons, and, yes, perhaps some of the tales that the clods told."
"You'd better not let Follman hear that."
"Of course, the text would have been extensively edited and re-edited over the years, and even passed on, perhaps, from cycle to cycle, the way Aethor and his people hoped to pass along the secret of gravitation. But my essential point is this, that it can't help but be a massive distortion, even if it is based on fact. For instance, consider the experiment with the holes in the roof that Faro and Imat were telling us about, the one that didn't work."
"Well, what of it?"
"Well, the reason why it didn't work..."
Sheeran stopped and rose in alarm.
"Uh-oh."
"Something wrong?" Theremin asked.
"Aethor's coming this way. Just look at his face."
Theremin turned. The old astronomer was moving toward them like some vengeful spirit out of a medieval myth. His skin was paper white. His eyes were blazing. His features were a twisted mask of consternation. He shot a venomous glance toward Follman, who still stood by himself in the corner on the far side of the window, and another at Theremin. To Sheeran, he said,
"I've been on the communicator for the past 15 minutes. I talked to the sanctuary, and to the security people, and to downtown Sorrow City."
"And?"
"The newspaper man here will be very pleased with his work. The city's a shambles, I hear. Rioters everywhere, looters, panicky mobs."
"What about the sanctuary?" Sheeran asked anxiously.
"Safe. They're sealed off according to plan, and they're going to stay hidden until daybreak at the earliest. They'll be all right. But the city, Sheeran, you have no idea."
He was having difficulty in speaking. Theremin said, "Sir, if you would only believe me when I tell you how deeply I regret..."
"There's no time for that now,"
snapped Sheeran impatiently. He put his hand on Aethor's arm.
"What about you? Are you all right, Dr. Aethor?"
Does it matter?
Athor leaned toward the window as if trying to see the riots from there. In a dull voice, he said,
The moment the eclipse began, everyone out there realized that all the rest of it was going to happen, just as we had said. We and the apostles, and hysteria set in. The fires will be starting soon, and I suppose Faliman's mob will be here too. What are we going to do, Sheeran? Give me some suggestion.
Sheeran's head bent, and he stared in long abstraction at his toes. He tapped his chin with one knuckle for a time. Then he looked up and said crisply,
Do? What is there to do? Lock the gates. Hope for the best.
What if we were to tell them that we'd kill Fullerman if they tried to break in?
And would you?
Sheeran asked. Athor's eyes sparked in surprise.
Why, well, I suppose...
No, Sheeran said. You wouldn't.
But if we threatened to...
No, no, they're fanatics, Athor. They already know we're holding him hostage. They probably expect us to kill him the moment they storm the observatory, and that doesn't faze them at all. And you know you wouldn't do it anyway.
Of course not.
So then, how long is it until totality?
Not quite an hour.
We'll have to take our chances. It'll take time for the apostles to get their mob together. It's not going to be a bunch of apostles, I'll bet on that. It's going to be a huge mass of ordinary townspeople stirred up to panic by a handful of apostles who'll promise them immediate entrance into grace, promise them salvation, promise them anything, and it'll take more time to get them out here. Observatory Mount is a good 5 miles from the city.
Sheeran glanced out the window. Theremin beside him looked also, staring down the slopes. Below, the farmed patches gave way to clumps of white houses in the suburbs. The metropolis beyond was a blur in the distance, a mist in the waning blaze of Dovim. Eerie nightmare light bathed the landscape. Without turning, Sheeran said,
Yes, it'll take time for them to get here. Keep the doors locked. Keep on working. Pray that totality comes first. Once the stars are shining, I think not even the apostles will be able to keep that mob's mind on the job of breaking in here.
Dovim was cut in half. The line of division was pushing a slight concavity across the middle into the still bright portion of the red sun. It was like a gigantic eyelid inexorably dropping down over the light of a world. Theremin stood frozen, staring. The faint clatter of the room behind him faded into oblivion, and he sensed only the thick silence of the fields outside. The very insects seemed frightened, mute, and all things were dimmer and dimmer. That weird blood hue stained everything.
Don't look so long at a time, Sheeran murmured in his ear.
At the sun, you mean?
At the city, at the sky. I'm not worried about you hurting your eyes. It's your mind, Theremin.
My mind's all right.
You want it to stay that way. How are you feeling?
Why?
Theremin narrowed his eyes. His throat was a little dry. He ran his finger along the inside of his collar. Tight. Tight. A hand beginning to close around his throat. Was that how it felt? He twisted his neck back and forth, but found no relief.
A little trouble breathing, maybe.
Difficulty in breathing is one of the first symptoms of a claustrophobic attack, Sheeran said. When you feel your chest tightening, you'd be wise to turn away from the window.
I want to see what's happening.
Fine, fine. Whatever you like, then.
Theremin opened his eyes wide and drew 2 or 3 long breaths.
You don't think I can take it, do you?
Wearily, Sheeran said,
I don't know anything about anything, Theremin. Things are changing from moment to moment, aren't they? Hello. Here's Bine.
26. The astronomer had interposed himself between the light and the pair in the corner. Sheeran squinted up at him uneasily.
Hello, Bine.
Mind if I join you? He asked. My reckonings are set, and there's nothing for me to do till totality.
Bine paused and eyed the apostle, who was poring intently through a small leather-bound book that he had drawn from the sleeve of his robe.
Say, weren't we going to put him away?
We decided not to, Theremin said. Do you know where Sephira is, Bine? I saw her a little while ago, but she doesn't seem to be here now.
Upstairs in the dome. She wanted to get a view through the big telescope.
Not that there's anything much to see that we can't see with our naked eyes.
What about Kelgash, too? Theremin asked.
What's there to see? Darkness in darkness? We can see the effect of its presence as it moves in front of Dovim.
Kalgash 2 itself, though, it's just a chunk of night against the night sky.
Night,
Sheeran mused.
What a strange word that is.
Not anymore, said Theramin. So you don't actually see the wandering satellite at all, even with the big telescope? Binet looked abashed. Our telescopes really aren't very good, you know. They do fine for solar observations, but let it get just a little dark and... He shook his head. His shoulders were thrown back, and he seemed to be working hard to pull air into his lungs. But Kalgash 2 is real, all right. The strange zone of darkness that's passing between us and Dovim, that's Kalgash 2, Sheeran said.
Have you been having trouble breathing, Binet?
A little, he sniffled.
A cold, I guess. A touch of claustrophobia, more likely.
You think?
I'm pretty sure. Anything else feel strange?
Well, Binet said, I get the impression that my eyes are going back on me. Things seem to blur and, well, nothing is as clear as it ought to be. And I'm cold, too. Oh, that's no illusion. It's cold, all right, Theramin said, grimacing. My toes feel as if I've been shipping them cross-country in a refrigerator car.
What we need right now, Sheeran said intensely, is to distract ourselves from the effects we're feeling. Keep our minds busy, that's the thing. I was telling you a moment ago, Theramin, why Faro's experiments with the holes in the roof came to nothing.
You were just beginning, Theramin replied, playing along. He huddled down, encircling a knee with both arms and nuzzling his chin against it. What I ought to do, he thought, is excuse myself and go upstairs to find Zephyra, now that the time before totality is running out. But he found himself curiously passive, unwilling to move. Or he wondered, am I just afraid to face her? Sheeran said,
what I was about to propose was that they were misled by taking the Book of Revelations literally. There probably wasn't any sense in attaching any physical significance to the concept of stars. It might be, you know, that in the presence of total and sustained darkness, the mind finds it absolutely necessary to create light. This illusion of light might be all that the stars really are.
In other words, Theramin said, starting to get caught up in it now, you mean the stars are the results of the madness and not one of the causes? Then what good will the photographs that the astronomers are taking this evening be?
To prove that the stars are an illusion, maybe. Or to prove the opposite, for all I know. Then again,
Binet had drawn his chair closer, and there was an expression of sudden enthusiasm on his face. As long as you're on the subject of stars, he began, I've been thinking about them myself, and I've come up with a really interesting notion. Of course, it's just wild speculation, and I'm not trying to put it forth in any serious way, but it's worth thinking about. Do you want to hear it?
Why not?
Sheeran said, leaning back. Binet looked a little reluctant. He smiled shyly and said,
well then, supposing there were other suns in the universe.
Theramin repressed a laugh. You said this was really wild, but I didn't imagine.
No, it isn't as crazy as that.
I don't mean other suns right close at hand that we somehow mysteriously aren't able to see. I'm talking about suns that are so far away that their light isn't bright enough for us to make them out.
If they were nearby, they'd be as bright as Onos, maybe, or Tano and Cetha, but as it is, the light they give off seems to us like nothing more than a little point of illumination, and it's drowned out by the constant glare from our six suns.
Sheeran said,
but what about the law of universal gravitation? Aren't you overlooking that? If these other suns are there, wouldn't they be disturbing our world's orbit the way Kalgash 2 does? And why, then, haven't you observed it?
A good point, said Binet. But these suns, let's say, are really far off, maybe as much as 4 light-years away, or even more. How many years is a light-year? Theramin asked.
Not how many, how far. A light-year is a measure of distance. The distance light travels in a year, which is an immense number of miles because light is so fast. We've measured it at something like 185,000 miles an hour, and my suspicion is that isn't a really precise figure, and that if we had better instruments, we'd find out that the speed of light is even a little faster than that. But even figuring at 185,000 miles an hour, we can calculate that Onos is about 10 light minutes from here, and Tano and Cetha about 11 times as far as that, and so on. So, a sun that's a few light years away, well, that would be really distant. We'd never be able to detect any perturbations they might be causing in Kalgash's orbit because they'd be so minor. All right, let's say that there are a lot of suns out there,
everywhere around us in the heavens, at a distance of 4 to 8 light years. Say, a dozen or two such suns, maybe.
Theremin whistled. What an idea for a great weekend supplement piece. 2 dozen suns in a universe 8 light years across. Gods, that would shrink our universe into insignificance.
Imagine it. Kalgash and its suns, just a little trivial suburb of the real universe.
And here we've been thinking that we're the whole thing. Just us and our 6 suns all alone in the cosmos.
It's only a wild notion, said Binet with a grin. But you can see where I'm heading, I hope. During eclipse, these dozen suns would suddenly become visible because for a little while there'd be no real sunlight to drown them out. Since they're so far off, they'd appear small, like so many little marbles. But there you'd have it, the stars, the suddenly emerging points of light that the apostles have been promising us.
The apostles talk of countless numbers of stars, Sheeran said. That doesn't seem like a dozen or two to me. More like a few million, wouldn't you think?
Oh, poetic exaggeration, said Binet. There just isn't room enough in the universe for 1 million suns, not even if they were jammed right up against each other so that they touched.
Besides, Theremin offered, once we get up to 12, can we really grasp distinctions of numbers? 2 dozen stars would seem like a countless number, I bet, especially if there happens to be an eclipse going on and everybody's wacky already from staring at darkness. You know, there are tribes in the backwoods that have only 3 numbers in their language. 1, 2, many. We're a little more sophisticated than that, maybe. So, for us, 1 to 2 dozen are comprehensible. And then it just feels like countless to us.
He shivered with excitement.
12 suns. Suddenly. Imagine it.
Binet said, there's more. Another cute little notion. Have you ever thought what a simple problem gravitation would be if only you had a sufficiently simple system? Supposing you had a universe in which there was a planet with only 1 sun. The planet would travel in a perfect ellipse, and the exact nature of the gravitational force would be so evident it could be accepted as an axiom. Astronomers on such a world would start off with gravity probably before they even invent the telescope. Naked eye observation would be enough to let them figure things out.
Sheeran looked doubtful.
But would such a system be dynamically stable? He asked.
Sure. They call it the 1-in-1 case. It's been worked out mathematically, but it's the philosophical implications that interest me.
It's nice to think about, admitted Sheeran, as a pretty abstraction, like a perfect guess or absolute zero.
Of course, continued Binet, there's the catch that life would be impossible on such a planet. It wouldn't get enough heat and light, and if it rotated, there would be total darkness half of each day. That was the planet you once asked me to imagine, remember, Sheeran? Where the native inhabitants would be fully adapted to alternating daylight and night. But I've been thinking about that. There wouldn't be any native inhabitants. You couldn't expect life, which is fundamentally dependent upon light, to develop under such extreme conditions of light deprivation. Half of every axial rotation spent in darkness. No, nothing could exist under conditions like that. But to continue, just speaking hypothetically, the 1-in-1 system would...
Wait a minute, Sheeran said. That's pretty glib of you, saying life wouldn't have developed there. How do you know? What's so fundamentally impossible about life evolving in a place that has darkness half the time?
I told you, Sheeran, life is fundamentally dependent on light. And therefore, in a world where
life here is fundamentally dependent on light. But what does that have to do with the planet that...
It stands to reason, Sheeran.
It stands to circular reason, Sheeran retorted. You define life as such and such a kind of phenomenon that occurs on Kalgash, and then you try to claim that on a world that's totally unlike Kalgash, life would be...
Theremin burst suddenly into harsh gusts of laughter. Sheeran and Binet looked at him indignantly.
What's so funny? Binet demanded.
You are, the two of you, an astronomer and a psychologist having a furious argument about biology. This must be the celebrated interdisciplinary dialogue that I've heard so much about, the great intellectual ferment for which this university is famous.
The newspaper man stood up. He was growing restless anyway, and Binet's long disquisition on abstract matters was making him even edgier.
Excuse me, will you? I need to stretch my legs.
Totality's almost here, Binet pointed out. You may not want to be off by yourself when that happens.